Welcome to New Books in World Affairs, and this is your host, Christian Peterson. And today I have the good fortune of speaking with Vikin Chatterjian about his new book, Open Wounds, Armenians, Turks, and a Century of Genocide, which is put out by Oxford University Press. Vikin Chatterjian, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Before we begin, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit more about your background and what got you into writing this book.
Yes, sure. So I'm talking to you now from a village in the Swiss Alps. I live in Geneva, where I teach international relations. Originally, I'm born in Beirut, Lebanon. I'm Lebanese-Armenian. I grew up in Lebanon during the war there, the 15 years of war. So from early on, I was very conscious about wars, about violence, about deportations and genocide from my family stories. Later on, I did my bachelor at the American University of Beirut. I studied literature. And after graduating, I worked as a journalist, first in Beirut, covering Lebanon and the Middle East. And later, I focused on post-Soviet developments by going to Yerevan, Armenia, and covering the developments in the South Caucasus and the North Caucasus in the period immediately after the collapse of USSR. And this experience was the raw material of my doctoral dissertation, later published as a book under the title War and Peace in the Caucasus, Russia's Troubled Frontier. In the States, it was published by Columbia University Press. The book basically argues why we had so many conflicts in the Caucasus in the period of the Soviet collapse. I have also worked in peace-building projects by bringing together journalists from different parts of the Caucasus, as well as in Central Asia and the Middle East. And after that, I moved to academic career. That's what I do now.
Okay, that sounds great. That's an interesting background. And what struck me about this book is how timely this issue is, being the 100-year anniversary. And you begin the book by talking about someone named, if I'm pronouncing the name correct, Hrant Dink.
Yes.
And I was wondering how you could, if you could explain to the listeners how you use that as a way to get into the book and pose some of the questions that you address.
Hrant Dink is a central figure in my narration, in my book. And this is so because Hrant was an Armenian Turkish journalist working in Istanbul, and he was assassinated in early 2007. And I start the book with asking, why was he assassinated? And it's kind of the introduction that brings me to my central topic, which is why the issue of Armenians, the Armenian genocide, but also the history of Ottoman Armenians before the genocide was long time forgotten, erased from memory in Turkey. For nearly 9 decades, this was a non-issue. It was completely forgotten. And then in the last 10, 15 years, the memory, the issue of the Armenians came back to public attention in Turkey. And each year we discover more and more books being written, people working on this issue, doing research. Many young students in Turkey are doing their doctoral dissertation in connection with the forgotten Armenian past in different fields, from people like studying Ottoman music and discovering that Armenians had enormous contribution in this field, or architecture, or whatever. It's not just, you know, politics and art history. And in this process of bringing memory back, Hrant Dink had a central role, because basically he is the first Armenian since 1915, since the genocide, who claimed to have a place in public sphere as an Armenian. So in Turkey, we had many Armenians, even after the genocide, who had a public role. You know, they were active in politics, often member of the Turkish leftist parties and so on. But all these people before Hrant were active not as Armenians, but as Turks. Very often they even changed their names so that no one discovers their ethnic background and their Armenian roots. Hrant was different. Hrant claimed, demanded that the Turkish public listens to him as an Armenian. And he, in a very popular, in a very kind of down-to-earth manner, he addressed the average Turk, the average Turkish citizen, and to his conscience. And he asked a very simple question. He asked, brother, sister, some decades back, there were Armenians living here. We see the ruins of their churches. We see the ruins of their schools. They are not here. What happened to them? Why did they leave? And he was assassinated because he posed these kind of questions. So Hrant is a central figure in bringing this memory back and this debate back to Turkey. And as a result, he's a central figure in my book.
Yeah, it's a very effective opening to use. It grabs the reader's attention and it helps you propel the narrative forward. And I like the transition that you used to raise the question of the history of the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire, and then during the reform period of the Young Turks, and then under the Turkish Republic. So I think the best way to go now is to give the listeners maybe a brief history of the experience of Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire.
The Armenians basically went through different stages, but the Armenian question, as part of the Oriental question, kind of rose in the late 19th century. More specifically, Armenians, as well as other population groups in the Ottoman Empire, were very much kind of mobilized as a result of sultans promising reforms. This is the age of the Tanzimat, the reorganization of the Ottoman Empire, because the Ottomans realized that the empire was in decline, that it was not anymore the power it used to be. Militarily, it was unable to compete with European powers, and economically, technologically, in all fields of civilization, they were left behind. So this kind of understanding that the sultans had in early 19th century led to three major reform packages being introduced. So those reforms promised, among others, equal rights and protection in front of law to all citizens. So no distinction was to be made from the perspective of the state whether a citizen was Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and so on. The problem is that those promises of reforms were never applied in reality. And as a result, we have tensions raising within the society. On the one hand, Armenians, Greeks, and other groups expecting reforms, while on the other hand, we have other groups fearing reforms, especially the Muslim elites fearing that they will lose their dominant position. On top of this, we have European powers increasingly interfering into the internal affairs of the Ottoman Empire. And in case we want to pick up one historical moment, to symbolize this, it's the 1878 Berlin Conference and the treaty that emerged afterwards, which demanded the Ottomans to introduce specific reforms concerning the Armenians in the eastern provinces, including reforms to safeguard their security and the well-being of their communities. For the young sultan who had just arrived to power at the time, Abdul Hamid II, he saw this European kind of demand to introduce reforms as a threat, and he started progressively seeing the Armenians as well as other religious minorities as a threat to the territorial integrity of the empire. So the Armenian question and kind of the Ottoman state targeting the Armenians as such starts from that period. And later in the 1890s, we have a series of massacres, anti-Armenian massacres, during the reign of Abdul Hamid II, in which probably up to 200,000 Armenians were killed as a result. So progressively, the Armenians are seen not as loyal nation as they were described in early 19th century, very much part of the tissue of the Ottoman society, but more and more they were seen as a threat by the state as a result of the combined elements I just described.
Yeah, it's interesting points you make. I was only partially aware of the high level of violence in the Ottoman Empire against minorities and Christians in particular. I somehow missed it in my graduate schooling. I mean, I knew bits and pieces, but for instance, the reactions against the Greeks in the 1820s, all the way up into the Armenians, it raises questions about the nature of imperial of non-Western imperialism, I guess. I would say. So from that angle, I think even specialists will get a lot out of reading it beyond what general readers get from it. But I mean, as you point out in the book, then you have the era of the Young Turks in World War I, and I guess that leads you to the genocide. So I was wondering if you could say more about this period between 1908 and into World War I.
I mean, before coming to World War I, I want to react to what you just said, that in spite of your interest in history, you had missed this violence that the Ottoman state exercised on its minorities. I have also come across a number of occasions, including discussing with Turks, Turkish intellectuals, who did not know about the Armenian massacres, about the genocide, about what happened to, one segment of their own population. And I would say that this oblivion, this kind of silencing, this very black page of history is not accidental. It's not. It was kind of planned. It's part of the official Turkish policy to negate the Armenian genocide by silencing it. This was the first kind of attempt Turkey to put an end to the question of the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire. And but also Western states who during the First World War, during the genocide itself, had insisted that those responsible of the massacres and deportations will be put to trial. But later, with the rise of Kemalism in Turkey, they kind of preferred to do business with this power in the East rather than to confront Turkey with its crimes. So, as a result, we have a long century during which I think this very important page in modern history was marginalized. Now to come back to First World War, what we have is that In 1908, we have a revolution in Turkey. And this is also very important because it's one of the modern revolutions during which the Young Turks, the Committee of Union and Progress, overthrows the Sultan Abdulhamid II and takes power. And it's very interesting to see that the Young Turks, the CUP, the Committee of Union and Progress, they come from officers, they come from army circles, or they are graduates of the medical institute recently established in Istanbul. And basically, they are the upper class Ottoman officials who fear that they will lose the empire, and they will, as a result, they will lose their dominant social position. So the objective of the 1908 revolution is to save the empire. And initially, Armenian revolutionary groups had collaborated with the Young Turks in 1908 revolution. And for example, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation goes on collaborating with them even after 1909 massacre in Adana in southern Turkey. Yet this collaboration doesn't kind of dampen the relations, and we have radicalization process taking place within the CUP in power, especially after the Balkan Wars in 1913, when the Ottoman Empire loses much of the provinces still under its control in European parts of the empire. And CUP finds that the First World War is a great opportunity to take its revenge, to regain the lost territories in the Balkans, and even to reshape the empire instead of being an Ottoman Empire based on religious solidarity. They imagine to build a new empire based on Turkic imagined national identity, which they imagine to spread it eastwards in the Caucasus and up to Central Asia, where Turkic peoples were under Russian rule at the time. And basically, Ottoman Empire jumps into this war. They were not part of the war. They could have chosen to stay neutral and save the empire. But the Young Turks, with their ideological indoctrination and positions, they take the risk, hoping that they will recreate a new base for the empire. And as a result, at the end of the war, they lose the empire. In the meanwhile, they use the war as an opportunity to get rid of elements, populations that they think will not be possible to assimilate in the new nation-building process. And those population groups are Christian populations, Greeks. So we start with deporting the Greeks even before the war, 1913 and 1914. And then we have genocidal deportations and massacres of Armenians, as well as of Assyrians, starting in 1915. So basically, the entire Armenian population of the empire, with the exception of Istanbul and Smyrna, Izmir, are deported to the Syrian desert. And in some cases, especially in the eastern provinces, they are basically massacred once they are taken out of their villages and towns. The rest of the population are, forced to walk in the heat of the summer of 1915 up to Deir ez-Zor in Syria today, where there's a war going on. And At least half the deportees die on the way because of massacres, because of deprivation, because of lack of food, because of exhaustion. And then in 1916, we have a new wave of massacres of those who survived the forced marches in Deir ez-Zor itself. So in February, March 1916, we have several hundred thousand killed in Deir ez-Zor itself. We have at the end of the war something like 300,000 Armenians surviving in what is now Syria and Iraq and Turkey, plus the population of Izmir. But there, at the end of the War of Liberation, 1922, Kemalist forces burned the Armenian and the Greek quarters. And as a result, the Armenians and the Greeks are forced to flee. So at the end of this cycle of violence, we have Armenians surviving only in Istanbul, plus in eastern provinces. But in the eastern provinces, they are forced to convert to Islam. They are Turkified, but mostly they are Kurdified. So Armenians become Kurdish and Muslim.
Yeah, that's an interesting part of the book as well, how you explain the role of the Kurds in the entire history of Armenian relations in the Ottoman Empire and in the Turkish Republic. And we can say more about that now or later. But what's also interesting is the fact that during the deportations and even after, there's forced conversion, there's rapes, there's people being forced into families, women abducted, children abducted. There's a whole interesting issue of identity that comes out that, for lack of a better word, is not just the act of deportation, but something that you bring up in the book that amounts to cultural genocide in a way.
Yes, indeed. There are many books published recently by Taner Akçam, by Fuat Dündar, that show that the Committee of Union and Progress had demographics in their mind when they elaborated the plans of deportations and massacres. Their thinking was that those Christian Armenians, Christian Assyrians, will not be assimilated into this future empire dominated by this new nation they are imagining. So they want to create a new Turkic empire, and they think that they can assimilate Muslim populations into their project. So they imagine that Muslim Albanians, Muslim Kurds, Muslim Caucasians, Cherkess, Chechens, even Muslim Arabs will eventually kind of be assimilated in this new project. But they think that Christian Armenians, Greeks, Assyrians will not be possible to assimilate unless they reduce their kind of concentration down to 10% in each province, and later they even shift this to 5%. So the massacres and deportations are done out of this kind of very modernist way of imagining, building a nation state using statistics, using demographic kind of givens and so on. So yeah, that's quite interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And the next interesting part of your book, in a book that has very many interesting parts, is how Kamil Mustafa Ataturk shaped the narrative behind the explanations for the plight of the Armenians during World War I and into the 1920s. In other words, how he framed the founding of the Turkish Republic really plays a strong role in what happens next in the story of the Turkish attitude toward genocide.
Yes. Even before Mustafa Kemal, we have similar attitude in the period of Abdul Hamid II during the massacres. And then Mustafa Kemal kind of takes all over that narrative, and it's part of the official Turkish narrative today, although that's evolving, and we can come back to that. But the dominant narrative during the Turkish Republic has been that first trying to silence the presence, the past, history of those populations that were destroyed during the First World War. So to erase their memory, to change names of rivers, mountains, villages, to convert their churches, to make them mosques, or to destroy them, to convert survivors, to force a new identity on them. And when it is not possible to silence their existence, then to accuse the victims to be responsible for what happened to them by accusing entire populations of having betrayed the state, of having collaborated with colonialist powers, Russian enemy, British enemy, French enemy. And as a result, the Ottoman and later the Turkish state having no choice but to dislocate those dangerous populations for the safety of the state, of the army, and of the public good. So this is the narrative. So it's their fault. Basically, it says nothing happened, and then it's their fault.
Yeah, and the Western imperialist link is used very conveniently to justify the violence. It seemingly it fits right into this mold that we've been victims of Western aggression, and that's used. And I would imagine, I mean, I'm not imagining, you make the point very clear that a lot of Turks bought that argument as far as justifying the plight of the Armenian.
Yes, this is a major kind of discourse that evolved in the Ottoman Empire in the 19th century. Mustafa Kemal took over, and even we find a similar attitude in the discourse of Erdogan today, the Turkish president, which says that we are anti-imperialist, that European imperialist powers are our enemies. So there's this kind of Huntingtonian polarization between us, the Muslims, the Turks, and the others, the Europeans, the Christians, the Westerners, and so on. Although when we look at history, this kind of polarized narratives have no ground. The Ottoman Empire survived the 19th century thanks to the intervention of a number of Western European Christian empires. Let's not forget that during the Crimea War, the British, the French, they fought the Russian Empire in defense of the Ottoman Empire. We have other examples when Muhammad Ali, of the ruler of Egypt, when he challenged the empire and his forces were marching towards Istanbul, it was European intervention that saved the empire. And later on, during the First World War, when at the end of the war the Ottoman Empire collapsed, we should not forget that the Ottomans chose to be part of this European civil war by choosing the side of the Germans. So there too, there's no polarization between us, the Easterners, the Orientals, the Muslims, and the others, the Europeans, the Christians. Even today, we should not forget that Turkey is a close ally of the West. Turkey is a member of NATO. There's NATO air base in southern Turkey, in Çevik, near Adana. So on the one hand, we have this anti-imperialist discourse going on, coming out from an empire itself. Ottoman Empire was an empire, So it's very curious that people buy this discourse of Ottoman Empire in the past and Turkey of today.
Yeah, and you raised two other issues related to World War I that I don't think are that well known. The first one being the German role in the genocide and the quote-unquote Woodrow Wilson's Armenia. I don't think a lot of people are very familiar with those episodes. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about those.
Yes, Germany has direct responsibility in what happened in the Ottoman Empire during the First World War, not only because the Ottomans were in alliance with the Germans, but also because Ottoman army was placed under German command, and there were thousands of German officers and soldiers present in all levels of the Ottoman forces. So, in case Germany on the political level, but also on the local on the level of local military commanders, they had wanted to stop this genocide from happening, they had all the means to do so. But they did not. On the contrary, they considered that this was something positive. Because Germany had developed anti-Armenian stereotypes at the moment of the First World War, and they considered the Armenians to be, negative for their projects in the Orient. Even there are episodes where German officers participated directly in some of the operations taking place. For example, the Armenians did not have the opportunity to resist in many cases, but they did show resistance in some. One of them was in Urfa, a city in southern Turkey today. The local Armenian community, because of their geographic position, they saw the deportees being pushed down the Syrian desert, passing near their city. And they understood what was happening. And as a result, they decided to resist. And when orders for deportation arrived, they refused and they reinforced their neighborhood and they resisted. And they managed to push away the Ottoman army that tried to break into their neighborhood. And then the Ottoman army demanded German officers to help them. And specifically by using artillery, they pulverized the Armenian resistance and they massacred the Urfa Armenian population and deported them. So we have this chapter, which I think is very important because, as we know, later Germany in the 1930s came under the influence of very strong nationalist currents. The Nazis came to power and eventually they perpetrated the most horrific of genocides in Europe. And so we have only few studies looking at possible continuities between German role in the First World War, in the Ottoman Empire, and lessons learned by German nationalists and later. How this was kind of put into practice in Europe itself. Now, coming to your second point on Woodrow Wilson. In fact, at the end of the war, during the peace conference in France, the question of the future of Armenians was put aside to a specific conference which took place in Sèvres, a suburb of Paris. As a result, there's the Treaty of Sèvres, in which it was decided that an Armenian homeland was to be created where the survivors of the deportations were going to be repatriated. Where they could have their own statehood. And the task of deciding the boundary of this new state, and specifically the border between this future Armenia and Turkey, was given to Woodrow Wilson. So there's a Wilsonian Armenia with a very detailed map defining the border between what was going to be Armenia and the future Turkish Republic. But the revolt led by Mustafa Kemal and his victory, the victory of the nationalists again in Turkey, overthrew those plans and the possibility of creating this unified Armenia as the homeland of the survivors of the genocide.
Yeah, it's interesting how that plays out and never comes to fruition, but it becomes a rallying cry for many Armenians as far as a vision of what could be fought for potentially down the line. And that's another interesting part of your book. But the point you made about Germany, I think, is very interesting. I think there's probably a very good dissertation there in that question about the relationship between, Nazi policies and the experience in Armenia or with Armenians during World War I. And you bring up an issue that I'd heard little bits about, but I'd never read in-depth details about a speech that Hitler gave about the role of the Armenians and his way of thinking about how to handle the Jews. I was wondering if you could say a little more about the controversies involved in that speech.
Yes, there's a controversy about a Hitler speech given from his summer house in Bavaria to high-level military officers just days before Nazi Germany invaded Poland. And so this is a long speech, over a few hours, first in the morning and then. And then in the afternoon. And what concerns the Armenian case, Hitler says to his officers, don't worry about committing massacres. Eventually, history will judge whether you are victorious or whether you are going to lose. And he says, who remembers the Armenians today? And there's a whole debate whether this phrase was said by Hitler or not. There is no official notes of Hitler's speech. There are no official records about it. There are three records which were taken by different officials in secret, and in one of the three we have this quote. And as a result, there's a whole debate whether Hitler did pronounce this phrase or not. Now, what is more important is that the Nazis were very conscious about how young Turks had exterminated Armenians and Greeks. And basically, they took this to be the force of Turkish nationalism. And in the 1920s, when Germany was in disarray, in chaotic situation, German nationalists dreamed to be strong enough to fight against the Treaty of Versailles and to kind of imply the same kind of violence and purification, as they would call it, to minorities of Germany itself, and as a result of this violence, create this pure Aryan nation that they imagined. In fact, recently there are a number of books looking at this interrelation between the Turkish experience, the Young Turks, and specifically the Kemalist experience, and how Nazis looked at them. For example, there's a 2014 book authored by Stephen Ehrig, Atatürk in the Nazi Imagination, published by Harvard University Press, looks how the Nazis in the 20s took Turkey and specifically Mustafa Kemal Atatürk as their role model, as the model of the Führer. And he has one chapter specifically looking at how Nazis debated, discussed, wrote about the Turkish example with the minorities, the Greek and Armenian minorities. And there are other books as well, recently published about this topic.
Yeah, I'm not sure that book would play that well in Turkey, from what I can gather.
There's a Turkish translation recently published, so it's
Really?
available. Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. And it's interesting. I wasn't aware of that book. I'm glad you mentioned it. And it leads into the next area where your book does a fine job of describing events, how various people tried to raise international awareness of this issue. And light, we'll come back to how the Turkish view evolves of this. But in order to break the silence, you have the efforts of Armenians, you have the efforts of people in the West, including you. One of the good parts of your book is one of the better ones, I would even argue, is the fact you bring out the idea of scholarship, how historians and various activists tried the problems of trying to raise awareness, and then the people who actually lived in the Turkish Republic tried to bring awareness to this. And I was wondering if you could say more, perhaps, about this topic, perhaps starting with the Armenians themselves. And I'm thinking of Armenians as a transnational community, both in the Turkish borders and outside.
I mean, before the Armenians, even during the First World War, there was tremendous effort to document what was happening. I think many people realized the importance of a state targeting part of its population by this kind of mass violence. And we have, even in Germany, we have Johannes Lepsius, who documented the atrocities, and he lobbied with German politicians so that they intervene and stop the massacres and deportations, although without success. In England, in Britain, we have an official commission which creates a commission of historians. The young Arnold Toynbee, the famous historian, is in
Yeah.
charge, and he publishes the Blue Book in 1916, based on eyewitness testimonies, and as a result, we have enormous documentation, and we know what happened even as early as 1916 back then. But then we have in 1919, 1920, the Istanbul trials, where after the war, when the Committee of Union and Progress escapes from power in 1918, at the end of the war, we have the liberals coming to power, and they want to bring the war criminals in front of justice, and they organize series of trials, and there too we have eyewitness accounts, testimonies, and so on. So even in Turkey, we have very rich material. And of course, the Armenians themselves did enormous effort of documentation going back to the days of the First World War. We have Aram Andonian, the journalist from Istanbul, himself a deportee, who starts documenting the organized nature of the deportations and the massacres. So he wants to show that the state is responsible. Those are not events taking place in the provinces where tribes are massacring Christian communities. No, he documents to prove that this is state-sponsored act of violence. We have Armenian refugees crossing to the South Caucasus under Russian Tsarist domination at the time, and there too Armenians in Tiflis, Tbilisi today, in Baku, Armenian intellectuals, they start documenting what happened to these refugees, what they lost, why they became refugees, and so on. So we have very rich documentation in the archives of of Yerevan National Archives, State Archives today. And after this period, culminating in the 1923 Lausanne Treaty, in which we have the emergence of modern Turkey and the end of any hopes of an Armenian homeland in eastern to the east of Anatolia, we have the end of this period of documentation, and instead we see that the Armenian communities are trying to reorganize themselves, the survivors in places like Aleppo, Baghdad, Beirut, Cairo, Marseille, Athens, and so then we have a new kind of documentation. Intellectuals start writing about the past, about what they lost, about the village life, about their community in different towns and villages of the Ottoman Empire, which are lost, which are gone forever. And also we have Armenian survivors writing about the experience of deportation and the massacres. But those books in the 1920s, 30s, and later stay within the community because the survivors have enormous difficulty to communicate with their environment, with their new environment. No one is interested in their plight anymore. And it's already extremely difficult to talk about such an experience. And it's even more difficult when the interest is lacking.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. And then you have the whole industry of people taking up writing about it in the West and the reaction to that. One of the points you make in you talk about and I don't want to go through all the names, but you talk about a number of scholars and authors writing about the Armenian genocide and the backlash from the Turkish government, including efforts to essentially fund think tanks to discredit the idea, endowing various organizations with money that speak out against the genocide, this whole kind of intellectual debate, and trying to discredit conferences that are put on. I mean, for a long time, I thought that was very interesting of how you see how important potentially, and at least anyways, how ideas and scholarship can be to changing people's minds.
Yes, Turkish official policy was, as I said earlier, was to erase the memory not only of the genocide, but also the memory of the existence of Armenians, as well as Assyrians, Pontic Greeks, and so on, by all kinds of state policies, by changing the language, the purifying, so-called, the Turkish language, getting rid of non-Turkic sounding expressions, changing, I mean, censoring maps, maps with geographic names. For example, historically, the Armenian inhabited areas geographically are called Armenian Plateau. And this was censored, you know, systematically by Turkey. In the book, I give an example how Swissair had a
Yeah, that's a
map
good one.
in the 1960s, and the Turkish ambassador in Switzerland wrote a protest letter saying that you should change this term. And Swissair did change Armenian Plateau to whatever it was. So we have a state policy trying to erase the memory of the victimized populations. But then, with the 1960s, with the revival of the Armenian movement, calling for international attention, calling for justice, calling for reparations, Turkey could not keep silence anymore. And as a result, it tried to propagate its own view. And this was done through financing university chairs, think tanks, especially in the States, because of the importance of the States globally, the importance of Turkish-US alliance, from all perspectives, political, military, strategic, and so on, but also elsewhere. For example, in Israel, there was a conference in the early 1980s in Tel Aviv on genocide, during which there were, if I remember right, four papers to talk about the Armenian genocide. And Turkey blackmailed Israel, even by threatening the well-being of Turkish Jewish citizens back in Turkey,
yeah,
to get what it wanted. And very often, Turkey managed to get results. But on the long run, this was a very short-sighted view. And eventually, Turkey today is not able to preserve this discourse in academic circles today, in circles studying Ottoman history, among scholars studying genocide and Holocaust. Today there's consensus about the Armenian genocide as genocide.
Yeah, and it also points to another part of your book where you describe the courageous efforts of Turkish scholars and activists to raise the issue and publish books and publish articles and hold conferences to discuss the issue. And what I didn't know this law actually existed. And I mean, I maybe heard rumors but that they were actually enforcing a law against people called, you know, being an insult to Turkishness as a crime for raising the issue of Turkey's role, or the Ottoman Empire's role, excuse me, in the genocide, insulting Turkishness as a crime.
One of the central questions I'm asking in this book is, why did the Turkish society come back to the issue of the Ottoman Armenians, the genocide, and the situation of the Armenians today? Why this interest emerged after long decades of silence and indifference and forgetting? So the other side of this question is, how was it possible for the Turkish society to be indifferent, to forget a crime of this magnitude that happened in their society? How is it possible to be a Turkish historian, to be a poet, to be a musician, to be whatever, and to be indifferent, not to react, not to notice that such a huge crime had taken place in their midst? It's not easy to give an answer to this question, the second one. How is it possible to keep such a long silence? And it's a question I asked each time I interviewed a Turkish person. My first question was, when was the first time that you came across the Armenian question? And for many, especially those who discovered the Armenian issue in the 1980s, it came to them by an accident. For example, for Hasan Cemal, the journalist, author, the grandson of one of the three authors of the genocide, Cemal Pasha, he first became conscious about the Armenian issue during the decade of the Armenian terrorism. Another person I asked this question is Taner Akçam. Taner Akçam is the first Turkish scholar who focused his work on the Armenian genocide. And it's extremely interesting to see how he discovered the Armenian issue. He came to this topic while working on a project on torture in Turkey. And by doing research, he discovered that there were massive massacres in the Ottoman Empire, the Hamidian massacres, against the Armenians and Assyrians. And later he came across the genocide. And he was shocked to discover this while he was in exile in Hamburg in Germany, working on such a research. And he told me, it's incredible that we knew everything about the Russian Revolution, we knew everything about Vietnam and Cuba, but we did not know our own history. So So there was really complete blackout on the Armenian past, on the Armenian genocide. And it's amazing to see how this story came back to be of public interest again in Turkey in the last 10, 15 years.
What role do you think that the terrorism played in it, if any, in raising awareness, moving into the 1980s, into the 1990s? Is that what, I mean, how do you place terrorism within the framework of your study?
Before terrorism, I would like to mention 1965. This was the
Yes, good point.
50th commemoration of the genocide, and Armenians in different places organized mass demonstrations. So this was really the coming out of the Armenians from 5 decades of silence. So there were mass demonstrations organized in places like Beirut, in Paris, in New York, in Los Angeles, but also in Soviet Armenia. And after this, Armenians became extremely active and mobilized, and they started demanding international political elite organizations, the UN, parliaments here and there, to recognize the genocide. And they were also asking for material and territorial reparations. Now, for 10 years, this political work gave no result. And so from 1965 to 1975, we have young Armenians radicalizing and saying that nonviolent political means gave no result. So what we have to do is to use violence. There's no other way. And in my book, I have a chapter on the decade of Armenian terrorism. And I show that this Armenian terrorism had two sources of inspiration. One source was past Armenian violence, Armenian revolutionary parties, the Social Democrats, and the Armenian Revolutionary Federation used violence, including terrorism, in the Ottoman Empire. So there's, this memory which is preserved and celebrated among Armenian communities. So there's one group of Armenian youth who drew on this past, but there's another one, Armenian activists in the Middle East, specifically in Lebanon, who were inspired by Palestinian guerrillas. For example, the Armenian Secret Army for Liberation of Armenia, they originate from a person who was a member of a Palestinian guerrilla group. And he was basically in the orbit of Yasser Arafat and other Palestinian guerrillas who were first in Jordan, and later, after 1970, they moved to Lebanon, and Asala, this movement, was anchored in Lebanon. This decade of terrorism initially put the Armenian question back into the mediatic agenda, because they put bombs here and there, and they mainly targeted Turkish diplomats in the Middle East, in Europe, in North America. And each time they kind of launched an operation, there was an avalanche of media reports following. But later on, they could not follow this initial success, mediatic success they gained, to move on to something more substantial. And eventually, this movement collapsed by internal strife, by internal divisions and internal assassinations. And well, the legacy of this movement is that it attracted international attention, including it forced Turkey to come out of its silence. And it's in this period that Turkey tried to articulate counter-arguments. And Turkish diplomats started writing books, putting together the official Turkish view on the past, on 1915, on the Armenian question, and negating that there was any planned genocide taking place, and that there's any possibility to compare what happened in the Ottoman Empire in 1915 with what happened in Europe with Nazi Germany with the Holocaust. So their main kind of objective was to diminish the importance of the deportations and to portray it as a simple dislocation of dangerous population.
Yeah, it's an interesting part of the book, and I know I've taken a lot of your time, but I have so many questions. Your book raises so many issues about the Armenian genocide, obviously, but just about history in general and how the world operates. One of the things, and I'll tell this to listeners, that you succeed in this book in doing, beyond having a lot of information that scholars will find valuable, is you bring a human dimension to the book, and you do this in a number of ways by talking about issues of identity, forced conversions. You have a chapter that goes through the issue of stolen property. You go on a trip looking at the ruins of churches of various cities to look at the trace of life that Armenians left behind that people don't always notice because it's been more or less obscured or purposely destroyed. I mean, you get a feel for people who are trying to figure out how to deal with their identity. It's really a fascinating part of the book that I don't think we can capture the full complexity of it in a short interview. But I was wondering if you'd like to say any more about how this book was, in some ways, if, and I don't want to be too bold, but a personal journey for you.
It was an incredible journey for me, but from the beginning, I was conscious that the material I had in front of me is huge and is extremely rich, and I wanted to put together this material the best I could. And to do that, I thought that on the one hand, I should of course do scholarly research, go down to the literature available, to the even archival research in some cases. But I also wanted not to limit myself with only using the official instruments of a historian. I also wanted to bring the sound and the color of what is happening today. I wanted to make this a living narration, and not just about the past, but how the past is present with us. And to do that, I thought I should bring together scholarly research and writing with narrations borrowed from journalistic writing, oral history, interviews with people, and bringing forward some characters who played important role, and me being privileged to have the opportunity to talk to these people and to bring forward their personal histories and stories. But also, I have one chapter traveling throughout Turkey, starting in Istanbul and ending on the border with Armenia at the ruins of Ani. And for me, this chapter is titled Memories of the Land. And for me, this is travel writing. So I wanted also to bring that to the reader. And concerning the first chapter that we already discussed about Hrant Dink, for me, the beginning of the book is like a detective story. There's an assassination, and by my investigation, by writing this book, I want to identify the mystery behind the assassination. So this for me a kind of detective story.
I don't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry. It was just really good. The issue of hidden Armenians and that kind of preoccupation with people trying to hide their identity or worried about the way they speak, or various people who have Armenian backgrounds who are afraid to admit that they have come from Armenian people who may have become Islamic and but speak with a certain dialect. I thought that was fascinating stuff.
Yes, and I wanted to. I mean, these are issues that are just emerging. So, today, in the last in the last few years, we have more and more people coming out and saying, listen, this is the story of my family. For 100 years, we lived in silence. We were forced to convert. My grandfather was a genocide survivor. He was adopted. He was, I don't know, converted. And, we want to tell our story. And I met some of these people, and I wanted to bring the experience of meeting them in the most vivid manner to the reader.
No, absolutely. It's well done. And another major, I'm going to make a segue here, but one of the major themes in your book, and you touched on it a little bit earlier, is the relevance of this topic for the modern world, in particular modern Turkey. You run through the book this idea that it's no accident in some ways that Turkey, the Turkish Republic, has taken the attitude that it has because of its domestic politics. And you have this idea of the deep state and how the attitude of the behavior of the Turkish government today, with as far as how it functions and how it deals with the Armenian genocide, are part of these larger issues about human rights and democracy in Turkey and how the Turkish Republic functions. I was wondering if you could say a bit more about that theme that you run through the book.
Yes, this is one of the central themes of the book. The question I'm asking, what happens to a society in case there's a crime committed and there's the pretension that there's no crime? So imagine Europe and its political culture in case Europe pretends that there was no Holocaust and that this is a marginal story and it's not very important. It's not the case in Europe, but it is the case of the Middle East. In the Middle East, up to now, everyone thinks that what happened in the First World War is of marginal importance. And I wanted to see the consequences of such an attitude. And the question I'm asking, in case we pretend that this is of no importance, we close our eyes, we silence the narratives. What will survive? What will emerge from such a behavior? And when I started my research, I was very conscious that, because I myself am Armenian, come from a traditional Armenian background, so I grew up with this experience that Turkish negation is a continuous pain to the survivors. And that's why the open wounds, or the title of the book. But I was surprised to see how far this goes. First, by discovering that the suffering of diaspora Armenians is very relative compared to the suffering of those Armenians who were left behind, who were forced to convert, and who were forced to live on the land in silence, while everyone knew that this person is the grandchild of a convert. And this person knew that in the village, who was the person who killed his, ancestors and took over the lands and the property and the church and so on. So while this memory was kept, it was silenced and emerged only at moments of conflict. So the pain these people had to go through during 100 years is something I cannot imagine.
No, I can't either. I mean, I can't. Yeah, it's something that, a lot of people in this country and in other parts of the world have no reference point for fully understanding. And you do a really good job of bringing that out.
But I want to link this with the deep state, is that I was surprised to discover while working on the book how relevant this experience is to Turkish society and to the Turkish political culture. Because by silencing the act of genocide, this act didn't disappear. It kept on leaving its traces in the society. And one of them, for example, is that you take people who committed crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, who are treated as heroes. So what happens when you shuffle your moral good and bad in such a way. What happens when you have a large portion of the real estate in the country was stolen and redistributed? What happens to the state of law, rule of law in that country when you have such a reality? What happens to domestic violence when you have thousands and hundreds of thousands of Armenian girls and women who were kidnapped, who were enslaved, and who became later mothers and grandmothers? So all the memory of this violence is still present in Turkish society. And what is the most dramatic is that the secret organization, which was set up and which was responsible for organizing the genocide, eventually survived. And it's still there. There's still this very secret structure within the Turkish state, which has no legal presence, but it has power concentrated in its hands. And this is, I think, one of the major obstacles for the future of democratization of Turkey.
Yeah, the more I thought about it when I read this book is how this issue would evolve. And there, you talk about it in some ways, in some parts of the book, about the getting into the EU with this type of elephant in the room, so to speak. It seems like it's a big hurdle for the Turkish Republic to have on its hand if it wants to become a full normal, if I use that term and with quotes on it, member of the European community or the European Union.
Of course, European aspirations of Turkey is one issue, and it has been a very positive kind of source to stimulate reforms in Turkey and try to dismantle this secret organization, the deep state within the Turkish state. I mean, European membership is one thing, but also the future of Turkey as a society respecting itself, respecting all of its citizens with all their diversity, and guaranteeing their security, safety, having rule of law is very relevant to the discussion we are having. You can't have rule of law and at the same time negate genocide and negate the fact that 100 years back there was a whole people who were assassinated and and their property confiscated. Up to today, there are fights, legal fights going on around issues of property. For example, just recently, the Armenian Church made a legal case trying to get back something like 2,500 churches and monasteries and the lands belonging to those churches that were taken over during the genocide, and they are still in Turkey.
Yeah, the Turkish Republic confiscated tons of stuff. One of the sections of your book talks about the religious foundations being seized. Just incredible amounts of property.
Yes, and the repression of the minorities, especially Armenians who survived in only Istanbul, went on. So by negating that Turkey was responsible of committing this act of ultimate violence, they legitimated their policies and kept on following on them. And so there was a very important Armenian population in Istanbul. By the way, Istanbul in 1914 was nearly half Christian, being, half of them being Greek, the other half being Armenian. So there was a very important Armenian community, very well established, very rich, very prosperous. And the Kemalist state targeted them and wanted to dismantle their economic role and to replace them with what they called a Muslim bourgeoisie. And the confiscation of Armenian property, whether land, whether capital in different forms, or whether property belonging to churches and foundations went on up to the 1980s. So this is
Yeah.
incredible. So I often say that in the case of the Holocaust, we know when it ended. Probably one symbolic date is when the Soviet army entered Auschwitz concentration camp. In the case of the Armenian genocide, we don't have such a date because we
No.
have only the beginning, traditionally commemorated on 24th of April when Armenian intellectuals were arrested in Istanbul, but we don't have an ending date.
Yeah, it's a tough issue. And as a way, it raises the point in the book, and I think they're interrelated sort of questions that how would you characterize, and we've talked about it a little bit, but how would you characterize the efforts of the Turkish government to deal with the issue of Armenians and the genocide, say, since the late 90s to today? And you don't have to mention all of them, obviously, but you describe a number of dialogue attempts and scholarship exchange attempts to try to reach some type of understanding between Armenia and the Turkish Republic, and by extension, the Armenian community. How would you characterize that, and what are the future prospects as we sit here in October 2015?
Since the 1980s, with the emergence of the Armenian issue following the decade of terrorism, Turkish officials tried to come out with a strategy of how to deal with this issue. But eventually didn't kind of bring any policy change. Up to the coming to power of the AKP, the party of President Erdogan today, which was in 2002, this made a break by the fact that there was a new team for the first time coming to power after the long decades of post-Atatürk elite preserving power. And AKP initially, when it came to power, it had the government, but it felt that it can be always challenged by the deep state, by the military. And as a result, in the first few years, Erdogan and his team, they were reformists. They were very liberal. And it is under those circumstances that we have the opening up of the debate on the Armenian issue in Turkey. It was thanks to this new hesitation, the kind of dual power between the Islamist government and on the one side, and the military nationalist deep state on the other, that it was possible to have the 2005 Conference on Genocide in Istanbul. Now, in the last years, as Erdogan kind of concentrated more and more power in his hands, especially after 2007, where he managed to kind of face the military and to subjugate them. Today, he has less and less kind of motivation to reform the system because now he dominates the system. And as a result, we have less and less change coming from the political elite in power. Well, Erdogan changed the official discourse from what I described initially, nothing happened and it's their fault, to saying that something has happened. We don't know very clearly what happened, but we should give more time to historians to work on this. So please don't intervene from outside. But also more and more characterizing what happened as civil war. So it's not a genocide, but it's a kind of civil conflict between two parties, Muslim Turks on the one side, or Muslims on the one side, and then Christian Armenians on the other. This new discourse, it's still denialist. It denies that there was genocide. It denies what is the most important for me is Turkish responsibility, state responsibility towards what happened.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And What I find interesting too, and something that you said, is that let's leave it to the historians to sort it out. And you raise a fundamental issue about the limits of taking that approach for a number of reasons, including the historians didn't do a great job of it, and the dangers of relying on that when the access to the archives for some of this information, especially in Turkey, is not always readily available. So I was wondering if you'd say more about why this idea of that you shouldn't just leave a question this important to historians.
Yeah, I think the question, such questions are larger than to leave just to specialists. You know, the question whether there was a genocide taking place in a society concerns not only historians, concerns everyone in a given. But more than that, we have also seen that during the 20th century, we can have historians serving the state and state propaganda and state objectives. So, just to say that, let's leave this to historians. Well, history shows that it's not the best solution. But also, in a more political sense, this argument wants to take the responsibility away from politicians. Well, I think politicians also have a responsibility, as well as ordinary citizens, as well as lawyers and judges, as well as poets and whoever. When it comes to a crime of this magnitude. So I think the argument is simply to silence the debate and not to kind of emphasize the importance of the historian in this context.
Yeah, when I read that, it made me think of the argument, just let experts deal with it. Don't worry your pretty little head about it. Keep it on the bat on the low burner, instead of people taking control and forming themselves, debating, grabbing history by the horns. That's the message I got. It's like it's much easier if people don't raise the issue and just keep it in conferences behind closed doors.
This argument has another problem, which is that, well, we are talking about an event which took place 100 years ago. Do we still need historians to research and to debate and to write and to reflect? In case after 100 years we are unable to decide the broad, the general lines of what happened, when we are talking about an event of this magnitude, deportation of nearly 2 million people, a confiscation of their property, massacres of hundreds of thousands. In case an event of this magnitude, we still need to reflect and to research and to work on, then what is the use of history in general?
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir on that. I'm doing research. I'm in the process of researching and eventually writing articles and books about the transnational movement to bring about Baltic independence during the Cold War. And it's not the exact parallel, although the Baltics had terrible deportations and huge population losses. I'm not, I wouldn't put it in the level of the genocide like we see with the Turks. I mean, maybe you can make an argument for cultural genocide in the Baltics, but that's the same type of issue of how do people bring attention to it, whether through scholarship, whether it's through protest, whether it's through inter exchanges. How do you get ideas out there for people to act on and react to? So I think it's an interesting part of your book.
Absolutely.
And I'm sorry, I'm taking up so much of your time, and you don't have to say a lot about this because we've been on quite we've been talking for quite a long time. But another good part of your book, and I don't think this is that well known, and I could be wrong, of course, but you also bring the issue of the Kurds and the subject of the relationship of Azerbaijan to the question of genocide and modern Turkey-Armenian relations, which is fascinating stuff to read, especially the Kurdish role in the genocide and the whole relationship to these issues, and the Azerbaijani Turkey connection, in terms of the how you mentioned that Azerbaijans portray themselves as victims a lot of the time. Azerbaijanis, I should say. I was wondering if you could just maybe say something briefly about that, about those issues.
Yes, as I mentioned early on, my initial research has been on the Caucasus and conflicts in the Caucasus. And I was very conscious that past traumatic events, genocides, silence, repressed, can be a source of tension, and it had played a role in the Karabakh conflict. What is interesting to see in the Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict around Karabakh is that today we have a new phenomena emerging whereby Azerbaijan has taken more and more the most hardline negationist, denialist positions, and Azerbaijani authorities, thanks to their petrodollars, Azerbaijan is an oil-rich country, is buying more and more influence within Turkey, media, academia, think tanks. So it negates that there was Armenian genocide, while on the other hand, it has official policy to talk about Azerbaijani people being the victim of genocide organized by Armenians. And this genocide is very diffuse, is very kind of unclear, and basically they attribute all negative experiences in the last 200 years to Armenians. So it's really fascinating to see the myth-making taking place with state-sponsored museums, with state issuing laws on the day of Azerbaijani genocide, and so on. Monuments being constructed. There's a kind of reversal of roles in the imagination of the Azerbaijani ruling elite. So this is fascinating, and we see the consequences of Turkish denialism kind of finding echoes in other places, other corners of this region.
Yeah, it's great stuff. And once again, thank you for speaking with me and sharing your book with our listeners. I've taken a lot of your time and I appreciate it. But I have one last question, and I was wondering if you could tell us perhaps a little bit more about what your future plans are, whether it's in writing or travel or anything.
My future plans is I'm focusing on a new book. I think my research on the current book, especially on the Ottoman 19th century, the reforms, the failure of reforms, and then the radicalization, gave me new ideas about rearticulating the modern history of post-Ottoman Middle East, which comprises Turkey, the Kurds, but mainly the Arab countries, looking at places like Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and so on. And basically, the question I'm asking is, what are the historical roots of the current Shiite-Sunni polarization and conflict, and why political Islam has become more and more reactionary and aggressive? And I want to research the root causes of those phenomena by going back to 19th century Ottoman history.
That sounds great. We look forward to that. And once again, thank you for speaking with me. I would just point out to the listeners, this is a great book for specialists and general readers, excuse me, alike, because it presents a lot of scholarly information, but it also provides a human dimension, and it's a very easy, straightforward book to read. And so I heartily recommend it. And before we sign off, I just thought of this as we were going through. I don't know how much you get of American culture or pay attention to it. We live in a bubble over here in the United States. But the issue of the Kardashians, are you familiar with the Kardashians?
I'm familiar because recently, I think just a week before the centennial commemoration, Kim Kardashian, she went to Armenia. I'm not sure for what, but she was very much in the media, both in the States but also in the Armenian media. So I noticed from that perspective.
Yes, the reason I mentioned they were there, it was more publicity, and I mean, I don't want to go too far, but I think they were trying to get back to their roots. They didn't really tackle a lot of hard-hitting political issues. But what it's interesting is it raises, by almost extension, what you're at least a little part of what you're trying to do in the book about the lack of knowledge about the Armenian genocide is most of the students that I teach, and this has been going on for years, are convinced that the Kardashians are Latin American. And they keep raising this issue that they're Latin American. And when I tell them they're Armenian, they really don't have any sense of what Armenia is, the Armenian genocide. I have to explain in the class how actually it's quite an amazing story of someone who, from I believe the early 1900s, left during an era of persecution in the Ottoman Empire and found their way. I think it's Kim Kardashian. I think it's her paternal great grandfather came to the United States. But it's a way that I think in club, when I teach world history, I use the Kardashians as a way to raise the subject of the Armenian genocide. And it's sad in a way how many Americans are convinced that the Kardashians are Latin American.
And why so? Why do they think they are Latin American?
Because they look, and one student explained to me just because they look Latin American,
Ah,
no other
okay.
issue. They did somewhat dark skin. I mean, there's no, I mean, they're not really thinking that hard about it. There's a lot of Latin American pop stars, so they're just part of that. That's as far as I can tell.
Oh, okay.
My poll's not scientific. So there's just my impressions from what I see in class talking to students when I teach world history. So anyways, once again, thank you, and I wish you the best of luck down the line.
Thank you very much.